I'm Dr. Vanessa Sinclair, an artist and psychoanalyst based in Sweden who works with people internationally, and this is episode 286 of Rendering Unconscious Podcast. My guest today is Julian Vane, a British independent scholar, author, and occultist. Julian has a class coming up on March 17th through Morbid Anatomy Museum online. It's 2 weeks, 2 hours each class, and the course is on sigil magic. To learn more about it, visit morbidanatomy.org/classes. There will be links to everything mentioned in the show notes and at renderingunconscious.org. Also, in a similar vein, Carl and I are teaching our class on the cut-up method called Harnessing the Magic and Creative Power of the Cut-up Method, a la William Burroughs, David Bowie, and Genesis Peoridge, which begins May 19th. It also runs on Sundays, but for 4 Sundays and 2 hours each class. You can also find it at morbidanatomy.org/events and at renderingunconscious.org. Coming up this Sunday, March 10th, we have our next Psychoanalysis, Art, and the Occult event online, Modern Occultism and the Need for a Limitless Search by Mitch Horowitz, and Occult Influences in Ezra Pound's Peace and Kantos, presented by Katrina McCook. That starts this Sunday, March 10th at 1 p.m. New York City time. And do note that the clocks change this Sunday in New York in the U.S., so please make sure you mark your calendars to New York City time. For example, here in Sweden, there's usually 6 hours difference, so it's usually at 7 p.m., but this time it's at 6 p.m. because of the time change. So please make note of that. You can find links to that at morbidanatomy.org/events, at psychartcult.org, and renderingunconscious.org. For more from Julian, please visit his website, julianvane.com, and follow him on social media. As with most episodes of Rendering Unconscious, there is a video accompanying this discussion at YouTube. Just search for Trapar Film at YouTube. Rendering Unconscious was awarded the 2023 Gradiva Award for Digital Media from the National Association for the Advancement of Psychoanalysis. Huge, huge thanks to all the guests and listeners and fans of Rendering Unconscious. I couldn't have done it without you. Rendering Unconscious now has its own Instagram page. Just search for Rendering Unconscious. I've also shifted my TikTok to be also Rendering Unconscious. And we have our own Patreon, patreon.com/renderingunconscious. For those who want to directly support the podcast, you can join me there, where I am posting exclusive content about the podcast, guests, listeners, musings, psychoanalytic theory, and more. If you are into magic and the occult and creative arts, you can join me at my Patreon with my husband, Carl Abrahamson, patreon.com/Vanessa23Carl. Huge, huge thanks for everyone who supports Rendering Unconscious and all of the work that Carl and I do. It's a big wide world out there, especially for independent practitioners and publishers. So thank you. All of your support really makes a difference. Thank you for sharing our links on social media and for reviewing our books and things on Amazon and other online retailers. It really, really does make a difference. So thank you. Well, hello, Julian. I'm so happy to have you here at Rendering Unconscious.
Vanessa, it's lovely to see you, and thank you so much for inviting me on the podcast. It's really appreciated.
I'm so glad that we get to talk longer. I was on your lovely podcast, My Magical Thing, but it was so brief that I definitely was left wanting more from you. So I'm so glad that we get to chat again.
Happy to oblige.
So what do you have going on at the moment, or what comes to mind?
gosh, there are so many things. So for the benefit of people that perhaps who are listening, who are less familiar with my work. So I'm an occultist, and so my background is all the kind of, I guess, you know, academics these days call it the Western magical tradition, but that's a little bit of a misnomer, since a lot of it is kind of, you know, North African, Indian influence, blah, blah. But anyway, so I'm kind of, my background is very much within the kind of the contemporary sort of esoteric occult practice. But over the course of the last, I guess it's like 50 or so years, I've become more and more involved in the whole kind of psychedelic field, because that's an important strand of occulture, is the use of psychoactives and mind-altering substances. And so it now turns out that all the weird stuff that I was interested in, particularly with regard to changing awareness using pharmacology, and specifically using psychedelic substances, that that's now something that lots and lots of people are talking about. So what's going on for me in that field, I guess, is like bringing to the kind of psychedelic discourse that exists around things like therapy, you know, the increasing market for retreats or psychedelic tourism or psychedelic pilgrimage, depending on how you like to frame these things, and bringing, I guess, like my kind of perspective on that, or the perspective that's kind of grounded in occulture primarily, and then goes into these other kind of fields. So there are some slightly different sort of ways of thinking about things, I think, that I'm able to bring to the party. And particularly at the moment, I guess I'm interested in, you know, we're at this point within the discussion about psychedelics where there's a lot of tussles over ownership, let's call it that, right? So there's a lot of kind of discussion about, you know, who should own these processes, how should they unfold? You know, there's a great tension, particularly for people in the United States and Canada and so on in North America, looking at the relationship between indigenous entheogenically lineaged communities and immigrant, very often European lineaged communities who are kind of now working with some of these substances. So there's kind of like an interesting tension there, particularly for people in those kind of settings. And often there's a sense of wanting to look at, I suppose, Europe, let's call it in general terms, this side of the Atlantic, that the British Isles right now as I'm speaking, and to kind of go, is there stuff we can kind of lock into from those cultures that mean that we don't have to appropriate somebody else's stuff, and somebody else's cultural kind of, you know, language and symbolism and so forth? And is there something that we can find that will help us navigate in this peculiar and emerging territory? And that's particularly, you know, I guess a lot of my interest is the way that these substances get used and the way that they're spoken about a lot at the moment. So I'm very interested in what I consider to be the overuse of the word trauma. That's some stuff that's happening for me right now. And there's like a brief summary of some of it, I suppose.
That's so interesting. And I think you're so right, bringing that perspective, bringing more magical perspective. The discourse is so important because it is pretty left out, especially like in the therapeutic use, and especially with just thinking of these things as like another kind of pharmaceutical, you know?
It's interesting because, I mean, there is it is understandable how people, particularly perhaps in the Americas, want to pay respect or homage to those entheogenically lineaged communities which historically have been prejudiced against and disrupted and even destroyed in the Americas. And so there's a lot of kind of, you know, people saying, oh, well, we should listen to, you know, the advice of these communities as far as using this medicine is concerned. And one of the pieces of advice that's very, very commonly given is that everyone who's in the space should be taking the medicine. So it is typical if you go to, let's say, you know, an ayahuasca session, whether that's contemporary syncretic session or whether or not that's something that has a cultural lineage that's very and many centuries deep, it is common for everyone to take the ayahuasca. You know, so what we and the same with, you know, peyote, whether that's within the Waralaka people, which are so-called Wacholi people, or within the communities further north in the Americas where that medicine moved in the 19th century. And yet, despite with the fact that often in therapeutic discourse in Euro-American culture, we kind of go, oh, we should definitely listen to what these folks are trying to tell us. One of the things that they often suggest is that everyone should take the medicine all at the same time. So so what we would describe as the therapist and the client or patient take the stuff at the same time. That, of course, is completely insane as far as a kind of Western pharmacological model of practice is concerned. You know, that's not what happens. You know, you don't go and see your doctor and expect that you will both be taking the same medication at the same time and sort of sitting around thinking about how it feels and so on. So there's one example of how, you know, it's okay to say a thing, but then when those communities of practice say, well, actually, you know, the thing we found works really, really well is this, actually trying to kind of say, well, are there ways of doing that? Are there mechanisms whereby we can bring those into what is admittedly a different cultural setting and a different lineage, a different story? You know, could we do that? I'll give you another example, which is that when in many cultural settings, certainly from my perspective within kind of occulture and within a lot of those entheogenically lineaged cultures, it is commonplace to introduce the idea or have embedded within culture the idea that the medicine, the substance that you're working with, ayahuasca, psilocybin, peyote, whatever, that it is a spirit. And what we could mean by the, you know, the ontological status of spirits, let's ignore that for the moment. Let's talk about functionally what that means. What that means is that we can interact with that thing as though it is an independent other with its own project and intelligence, and that we can come into a relationship with that in the way that, you know, you and I are in relationship at the moment. You know, despite the fact that Vanessa is actually like a tiny little square on a computer monitor, hopefully we're interacting like actual people. So that's one of the things that's really, really commonplace. And I remember having a conversation with a researcher, let's just call him, in a licensed setting, and me saying, well, actually, one of the things that I find really helpful when I work with people with these medicines is to say, again, whether you believe in this or not, for the purposes of the project, let's just interact with this medicine as though it is a being. And there are many benefits of doing that as a practice. And I remember the researcher saying, well, we can't do that in a kind of Western setting. How are we going to kind of tell people to interact with the thing as though it's a spirit? And that's completely off piece. That's crazy talk. It won't work. And I said, well, actually, I don't think that's true, because we actually interact with things that we don't normally give personhood to as persons all the time. If you've ever found yourself in a situation where your printer on Friday afternoon is refusing to print, see, even the way I phrase that, is refusing to print a document, what you do is you say, printer, what's wrong with you? What do you need? Why do you always do this to me? So you apply personhood to the printer. The reason you do that is because the biggest sections of your brain, both in terms of absolute mass and connectivity, are sections which are about interpersonal interaction, because you're a hominid, and that's how you work. So by applying personhood to the printer, that allows you to problem solve more successfully than if you assume that the printer is just a dumb object and it doesn't have this personhood. Personhood is a means to successful problem solving. So I remember saying to them, giving this as an example to this particular person who's a licensed researcher in the psychedelic field. And, you know, they seem to take it on board. But whether or not that translates into a situation where you are actually kind of, you know, here's this person, they come into the session, they come into, a licensed therapeutic session, they come into a research setting, maybe they come into a ketamine clinic. And we say, okay, so for the purposes of what we're going to do today, you might choose to engage with the ketamine as though it is a being. You might choose just in your head to speak to it in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter about whether you think this is ontologically true or not. It is it's a mind hack, we could call it. You know, if we want to kind of keep it very, take the spirituality weirdness out of it. It's a mind hack. It's a strategy that allows us to do this. So a lot of what I'm doing at the moment, what I've been doing for the last, I guess, few years really, is bringing stuff like that, that in the occult space is just, that's how we do things. That's that's the strategies. And bringing that into these other kind of spaces and hoping some of that is helpful for practitioners who are from other lineages and other stories.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And that is so important. And I often say that, like, people ask me, like, oh, do you believe that there's really entities out there, or is it all psychological? And, like, personally, I used to think I believed in it when I was younger. Then I got normalized through my education and becoming a psychologist. And then I started seeing everything as, like, symbolic and psychological. Then I had some initiations and real experiences where I'm like, oh, no, there's entities. And now I'm just like, you know, people should believe whatever works for them, you know, whatever works. So if someone's going to be off put by thinking of it as a real spirit, but a lot of people, like, in the magical community, think of all plants as having their own spirit, you know. And that makes you think about the earth very different. You know, maybe you should think about the earth as being alive, because clearly it is, rather than thinking it's just like some rock that should be mined for all of its resources. But that's the difference between, yeah, people who are more capitalistic in that way and people who are more animistic. But yeah, if you can bring some of that more animistic thinking and just say, like, yeah, it's a cognitive strategy to kind of keep it within their comfort zone, it'll still work, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And if you, it's interesting actually, because you mentioned animism there. One of the things that I think is really fascinating is there is a return to a kind of intellectual engagement in kind of, you know, again, I'll call it Euro-American Western culture. You know, these words, they're all in exact, but they do. But there's a real return to ideas about animism and particularly panpsychism, you know, to the point where when we talk about, and to some extent, this is an inevitable function of our language. You know, we talk about particles deciding which slit they want to go through. And it's very, very difficult to kind of to take personhood and take agency and take consciousness out of language. I mean, you know, even if you do it in, even if you have the most rarefied form of language, which is arguably mathematics, mathematicians that I speak with and people whose work I've read talk about the importance of beauty in relation to mathematical proof. So that's an intriguing idea. So even in this, one might imagine a very kind of austere, very stripped down way of viewing the universe, still aesthetic kind of qualities are part of how that operates and part of how, you know, mathematicians in particular look for interesting relationships between the kind of concepts that they're dealing with. So I think that a kind of a return to an animism or a panpsychism and a kind of reinjection of that into culture, I think, is really, really helpful. And yeah, you know, the ontological status of this stuff, that's always open to question, always has been, probably always will be. You know, that's, and a lot of these questions for me, you know, is it psychological? Is it external? The example I often give about this is that it's a little bit like, you know, what you're really talking about is topology. You're not talking, you know, you're talking about surfaces. What you're saying is this thing inside me, inside this network of tubes that I identify as like an individual self and body and so on, is it in there or is it outside there? And the thing about that is that that's like a very, it's an understandable way of wanting to explore the universe and make sense of things. But it's really, really fundamentally limited. Because even if you take aside anything sort of particularly woo and strange, and you say, well, when you talk about you, when you talk about your psychology, do you mean the 2.5 pounds of electrified fat? Do you mean the whole of the nervous system? Do you mean the microorganisms that are in your gut, which metabolize your food? where the variation in that ecology in the gut ultimately transpires into variations in emotional tone and behavior. Do you mean your language, which sort of nominally lives inside you, but clearly is also an artifact that exists within culture and that can't be said to be purely inside the tube or outside of the tube? So this kind of notion of that I think, you know, developed in the through the sort of, I guess we could say, you know, like Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, all these kind of people, this kind of idea of like an individual sort of, a word that often gets used, a sovereign identity, sovereign kind of self. There is certainly value in that way of seeing the world. But the notion that this is like the default of that it's more realistic than anything else, or more well informed, or more nuanced, or even more productive than any other way of seeing the world, I question. You know, I think a lot of the time we're using linguistic structures inside outside. You know, up is good, down is bad. You know, all these metaphorical structures that we operate kind of within. Often talk about things that it's very hard to really explore within those styles of language. You know, we're rather like people in the mathematical, you know, the story of Flatland, you know, this two-dimensional world, and one day a sphere falls through Flatland, and all the creatures on Flatland, who are two-dimensional creatures, argue about whether it was a dot or whether it was a circle or whether it was, they can't conceptualize the sphere. So a lot of our language is always going to be about position and relationship. And yeah, you know, I thought for a while that the world was all this kind of big interconnected network of symbols and meaning. And then I started thinking that perhaps it was purely internal, whatever that means, inside this thing that I identify as me. And then I have some other experiences and I realized that actually, no, it's much more complicated than that. Yes, it probably is. And there's probably... And unless we go for poetic language, it's probably, if not conceptualizable, but certainly very difficult to express within the terms that we often use.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that people are so identified with is really just like your ego is just really like a very small part of yourself, you know?
Or even, you know, ideas like... consciousness is a brilliant idea. It's so interesting, and a lot of these sort of psychic structures that we talk about, you know, conscious and subconscious or unconscious, we talk about, you know, ego and identity, we talk about drives and all these sorts of things, and I find these fascinating because they are contemporary pieces of mythology, not in a derisory sense, but they're conceptual structures which help us make sense of the world in certain kinds of ways. So if you take something like consciousness, we can talk about that in all sorts of ways. You know, we can talk about Thomas Nagel's famous paper, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? You know, like, what is it like to be Vanessa Sinclair? What is it like to be Julian Bain? What is it like to be is one idea of consciousness. Another idea of consciousness is this idea that it represents a sort of a state of being that's often counterpointed to something like unconsciousness. So one might say that when we're awake, we're conscious, and when we're asleep, we're unconscious. Now, that's okay up to a point, but when you start to look more fine-grained at this, you realize that a lot of this stuff starts to really, really break down. Do you need to be conscious to drive a car? Yes, by and large, you need to be conscious to drive a car, except I can point to you plenty of examples, well-attested examples of people who were asleep and managed to be asleep and get up and even dress and get their car keys and drive themselves onto the freeway and then suddenly wake up to find that they're driving their car. So do you need to be conscious to drive a car? Yes, most of the time, but also some of the time, clearly not. You can drive a car without being conscious. And then you've got all those lovely thought experiments about brains in vats and all kinds of things to play with these ideas. So I think that, you know, it's, I nearly said it's blindingly obvious, but because for some people it's always the first time they've heard this. The map is not the territory. The way that you describe a thing is not a thing. by definition, it must be a simplification and it must leave information out. So any of those conceptual tools is a simplification for the purposes of doing something else, usually, you know, like things like therapeutic structures, conceptual therapeutic structures, acceptance and commitment therapy, or internal family systems, or psychoanalysis, or any of these things. As far as I can see, the primary value of those things is to make the therapist feel comfortable and confident that they can cope with whatever walks in through the door. That's the primary sort of, you know, it's like, okay, I think I've got this, you know, the complexity of human life. I've read this stuff and I, you know, I like these things, you know, like Winnicott, that's really good. And, you know, these different sort of theories, I've got this kind of model in my head. And basically that's my that's my psychic life preserver, which I'm now going to use to go into this environment in order to meet whatever it is I'm going to meet. The problem is when we start to believe that those conceptual structures are true, mm-hmm. or absolutely true, which is even more frightening. I mean, death to fanatics, of course. In that, what we do is we then start only seeing the world through that filter, mm-hmm. and inevitably, always, things will be left out. And sometimes the things that will be left out will be really important.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And as far as like magic and psychedelics coming into the mainstream more, why do you think that's happening now?
I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, one is that if you start to get a place in culture, by which, I mean Euro-American, Western, English-speaking, predominantly, blah, blah, culture. So place in culture where you start to get these ideas which panpsychism, for example, which is now being, you know, like there's a lot of discussion, there's a lot of writing about that, there's a lot of philosophers who identify as being interested in that kind of field. That view of the universe and the view and the notion of, say, the world soul in, say, Hermeticism, the idea that, well, basically, yes, everything is alive for a given value of aliveness, or everything is consciousness in a certain sense. You know, stones have stone-like consciousness, and wombats have wombat-shaped consciousness, and they may well be significantly different, but there is, in some sense, an awareness that sounds really like Hermeticism. I mean, it is. You know, you can draw historical lines from that as well. So the reason that a lot of the kind of esoteric magical discourse is now relevant, one reason for that is because these old and new ideas, as they reemerge, people kind of go, so who else thinks about stuff like this then? Who you know, what other things have we got? And the other reason, which I sort of pointed to earlier, is this desire to look at a kind of, particularly for, you know, European descent people in, say, the United States, is like, is there another lineage of working with psychedelics in particular? Are there other ways that we can trace this into, quote, our culture or European ancestry culture that allow people in those kind of those, you know, there's difficult settings where there's, you know, histories of genocide and colonialism and oppression and all these kinds of things. Can they start to make more sense of their practice in a way where they could see its roots in places that they feel more identified with in one way or another? And so if you look at the occult tradition, although the use of, say, what we would call kind of psychedelic substances, tryptamines, for example, mushrooms, there are tiny little pieces of information about that sort of scattered through the corpus of history. But there are certainly very, very well attested to techniques of using these substances to alter awareness in order to do quote, magic. You know, there's John Dee and Edward Kelly doing their scrying. And everyone knows that they did scrying, and everyone knows, you know, the kind of craziness that went down with that. But what many people failed to appreciate is that the scrying sessions were sessions that involved significant quantities of psychoactive substances, ones that these days we consider not very potent, things like frankincense, unless you burn an awful lot of it in a room, which at which point you will definitely notice its effect. But certainly things like hellebore and henbane and cannabis and so on, they're part of that lineage. So I think that part of the interest in our culture is because it represents an old world, let's call it perhaps, an old world lineage of making use of psychoactive substances and of curating those in particular kinds of ways. So that's another reason I think it's interesting, you know, that people are kind of intrigued by this now.
It is very interesting. And it's also interesting to me always, like, it's interesting to see these ideas becoming more in the mainstream because of, like, my whole life they haven't been. And it's like, whoa, the ways that I think and people I know think, like, people are talking about, like, on the news and stuff like that, which is, and on TikTok, of course, things like that, which is interesting. And it's interesting to see over time, like, how these ideas are repressed. Like, from the 60s, of course, there was, like, a emergence of these ideas, and then it was kind of suppressed. And obviously, at the turn of the previous century, it was a similar thing. And why do you think that happens? It seems to get, like, consciously repressed by it, the control systems, or left out, like, even in art history books and things, like, a lot of artists that were magical practitioners, you know, that's completely not even mentioned when you teach art history, as if it's, like, something completely separate from their creative practice. It's very odd to me.
See, that's a really good example, actually, Vanessa, because if you take something like, I mean, you and I, I'm sure, very aware of that over the course of the last, what should we say, 10 years, perhaps, if we're being really generous. I mean, in my head, I date it from a show called The Dark Monarch, which was at Tate St. Ives in, I want to say, 2008, something like this. So a little bit longer now. And I remember going into that show in this, you know, high status gallery down in Cornwall and going, oh, my God, there's a copy of the Lamp of Thoth magazine. And there's a drawing by Austin Osmond Spare. This is like,
wow.
Wow, this is amazing. You know, there's some collage by Penelope Slinger, you know, like this person who I know from, like, you know, kind of tantra and esoteric stuff. And, like, suddenly this is all in mainstream galleries. A couple of years ago, I went to the Venice Biennale, and there's, like, this huge, massive celebratory thing about, like, female surrealists. And there's all these people who, yes, they're artists. Of course they're artists. But in my head, they're also, like, absolutely profoundly occultists, you know, people like, you know, Leonora Carrington and Romana Savaro, and people like Maya Deren. You know, there was, some of her, some shots from Witch's Cradle, I think it was, in there. How can you understand the work of Derek Jarman? How can you understand the work of this filmmaker unless you understand Derek Jarman's interest in alchemy and magic? You know, how can you understand, actually, the work of people like Jackson Pollock unless you understand his interest in shamanism? You know, and that's really, that. In fact, Pollock is a really interesting example because, you know, when the work first emerged, it was presented as, oh, this is, like, properly modern. This doesn't have any kind of weird associations with any kind of, like, symbolism. This is all about, like, the action and the artist and the blah, blah. And until you actually go and, like, look at things like the titles of a lot of these pieces, or you start to study a bit of the history of the artist, and you start to go, do you know what? These people are all doing these practices. So that brings us to the question that you've raised, which is, like, how come? Why is this repressed or oppressed or ignored or whatever? I don't know is the answer. I suppose one reason perhaps is that, understandably, there is a degree of woo that any of us individually are happy with. And beyond the woo, the Venn diagram, the woo that we like, there is the woo-woo that we find a little strange. And then the woo-woo that we go, oh, my God, really? You know, isn't that just, like, total QAnon nonsense or whatever? You know, so there's the kind of, there's our tolerance for weird. You know, we have different tolerances for weird, I think, as individuals. And it's probably on a you know, it's probably on a straightforward bell curve. Some people totally happy with all weird things. And some people like ain't no weird things. Most people somewhere in between. So it's partly to do with tolerance for weird. Partly as well, I would say that, and I don't know, I mean, you know, you're more familiar with Genesis both as a person and probably their works than I am. But one of the things that I think comes over in some of the Temple of Psychic Youth material and in a lot of the occult tradition, a lot of the contemporary, the sort of modern occult tradition, so like post-60s, is this idea that, and I think this is there's a longer lineage in this as well, occulture is very much about a kind of individual or peer group practice. So although it might have all kinds of clusters of ideas and beliefs and, you know, even kind of sacred text, you know, there's Alistair Crowley getting his channeled document from like some, you know, spirit entity in 1904. But it's fundamentally about trying stuff out. It's actually about like, it's axiological. It's like, it's a doing, right? So in religious contexts, what we are often doing is we are following a predetermined a set of beliefs, a kind of an established credo, and we're often doing rituals and practices which are ones that would be very familiar to people, you know, 300 years back in the tradition. Not that these things don't change, but they are more small-c conservative. Our culture, by its very nature, and you can even, you know, there's John Dee and Edward Kelly doing their crazy stuff. They were experimenting. They were discovering new angelic language. And that's really interesting, isn't it? So, like, here are these two occultists, and whatever one might think of their project, their project was certainly about the discovery of a new vocabulary for esoteric work. And I would say that the reason that occulture finds it finds that it is, if not actively suppressed, then at least often not encouraged, is because it is about, as I believe both Socrates and Timothy Leary said, that thinking for yourself and questioning authority. You know, it is about finding what this means for you and for your affinity group and for your community. So it's not about simply reproducing whatever has been handed to you as culture. It is about drawing from multiple sources, because it's always highly syncretic, even in, you know, so-called ancient traditional settings, it's syncretic. Bringing these strands together and weaving an individual creation that's unique to the person, to the time. And so one might make a suggestion that rather like psychedelics themselves, particularly when they escape the boundaries of therapy and the boundaries of research, they are, this is a practice that is imagined to be destabilizing of mainstream status quo culture, and therefore is of concern. And so we enact all the strategies, you know, from saying this is all nonsense through to occasionally setting people on fire and destroying their books and so forth. So I think it's that, you know. And I kind of don't want to say that because it sounds really conspiratorial, but I think that's an emergent property rather than, you know, someone in charge going, we mustn't have magicians, they're really dangerous. I think it's more an emergent property of culture. And I think when culture goes through periods of destabilization, and there is a good case for arguing that we're in a significant one of those now, that those ideas become more appealing for a variety of different reasons. And so, yeah, that I think is what's going on.
I think so too. And that was really beautifully put. And I think the culture needs to be in a period of destabilization because of what we're doing to the earth, you know, to our habitat, and having treated it so poorly for so long. And yeah, we're like really at a critical point. And so it makes sense that like there needs to be some disruption, and people are going back looking for older ideas that maybe worked better, or ideas that are being practiced other places that might not be so dominant, but also work better, work more like in harmony with the earth rather than just being so exploitative.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. And I think that the, it's really interesting. I mean, if you look at the sort of, I mean, obviously everybody in every point in history thinks that they're at some sort of critical juncture. You know, people in 1666 were absolutely convinced that any minute now the Second Coming was going to happen. And then when the Great Fire of London happened, that was clearly a sign and so forth. So that's, you know, it has always been thus. And I think at the moment, you know, we've got this really interesting thing. We've spun a global brain across the planet. And increasingly, particularly through the use of mobile phones, a large number of people have got access to that. Even sometimes people who are find themselves in very, very difficult circumstances still have access to the internet in one form
still
or another.
Have a phone. Yep.
Yeah. So we have this simultaneous thing. It's a little bit like the pandemic in the sense that it's like a global shared experience, but the individual stories within it are hugely variable. And I think that itself is really interesting. Because the idea that you can have this shared common humanity, you know, we can sort of look back in the whole Earth catalogue away and go, oh, look, it's actually like a tiny little planet there, isn't it? So there's the kind of the tension between the common human experience and also then the individual narratives that exist within that. And trying to kind of navigate that is very, very challenging. It's very, very difficult for many of us, you know. And so I think that techniques and tools that that are able to invite us to kind of engage in some kind of self-inquiry or group inquiry process, and also allow us to hopefully maintain a kind of an open-minded curiosity. You know, occultism by definition is the study of that which is hidden, which is like really kind of deliciously paradoxical. So you're studying the thing you can't know. Yes, that's right. We're studying the thing you can't know. You know, it's very much like, you know, at its best, looking at something like psychoanalysis or something where we talk about, you know, the unconscious, the subconscious, that's the thing we can't know by definition. And so our practice is like trying to figure out entertaining ways that we can sort of, you know, work with that unknowing. And I think that this idea of being able to work successfully with unknowing is probably one of the reasons that some of these kind of ideas are flowering now, certainly in the kind of Euro-American context. I would be fascinated to find out more about it because, like, you know, I'm embarrassingly locked into English, and I don't know what the story is with these things in India or China or, you know, further east in Europe or indeed in Russia. But I think that in those times of disruption, that things that allow us to be with uncertainty and to be curious rather than either defensive or just too credulous and accept whatever other people tell us about the thing that we don't know. And uncritically absorb other people's narratives. So things that allow us to be curious and provide us also with technique. So that's another important thing. I think the thing about occulture is that it's all very well to have all kinds of ontological stuff and philosophy and special names for things and blah blah, but it's like, okay, dude, yeah, but what should I do? Should I close my eyes? Should I stand up? Should I breathe in a funny way? Should I eat these mushrooms or not? What should I be doing to actually kind of to do this exploration about which you speak? And so the fact that those traditions, those discourses, can provide people with methods, and so, well, look, You know, this is what Gautama Buddha did. He did a thing called meditation. Like, it looks like this. Go and give that a try. See, you know, whether or not you get to touch the earth and come up with a brilliant idea about the nature of the universe. You know, so you can give the techniques rather than giving the answer. You know, so rather than turning up with a book that says, hey, guys, this is the book from God. Look, God is, you know, as is traditional, on top of a mountain somewhere in a remote location, God has sorted me out with a text and I'm going to simply give it to you. It's like, no. I want to find out what happened when you were up the mountain. That's what I want to do. I want to find out what it was that allowed you to receive this thing from God, because the output isn't the thing I'm interested in. I'm interested in the method, mm-hmm. You know? And that's, I think, what aquaculture can bring to the party.
Absolutely. And speaking of method, I know that you're teaching a class on sigil magic at Morbid Anatomy soon. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, really nice to be working with Morbid Anatomy. So this is going to be a series of workshops, online workshops, about sigil magic. Sigil magic is a practice that is most often identified with the work of Austin Osman Spare, British artist occultist. And we're going to be exploring a whole variety of different ways that we can use this technique, which is essentially, in fact, if we use psychological language, it can be described as a technique whereby we can take intentions and desires and we can encode them in a way that can be dropped down into the unconscious mind there to let them flourish. And partly I'd use psychological language because Austin Spare in his books uses that. You know, his most famous book is the Book of Pleasure, which is subtitled the Psychology of Ecstasy. Now, that's what he's talking about, uses that language. So we'll be using techniques to kind of create these, often they're graphic images, but they can be done in a variety of modalities. They can be done as, you know, music or scent or gesture or whatever, but often they're kind of graphic images that we create to encode a meaning and then that we empower in some way and that we drop into the unconscious to allow them to grow there. So that's what we're going to be doing. Going to be doing some other teaching as well with Tradwell's, the esoteric bookshop in London. So I've got a course coming up at the end of this month, which is about chaos magic, style of postmodern or metamodern magic developed in Europe in the latter part of the 20th century, and a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, people want to kind of connect with me on, you know, Instagram, Facebook, blah, blah, the usual things, then they can see what I'm getting up to.
Yes, and I will link to all of those places. And you have a great blog with Steve D and all sorts of wonderful things.
Well, Vanessa, it's been lovely, lovely talking to you. Really, really appreciate it. Just a few little points there, and I just kind of ran with it. I hope I didn't, take
over
the show too much.
That's exactly what we're going for here. See what's on your mind. It was lovely, lovely to talk with you, and I definitely would love to have you back again sometime.
I'd be very, very happy to come back again. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's really appreciated.
All right. Bye, Julian.
Yes, Vanessa. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Rendering Unconscious. You've just heard a discussion with Julian Vane. For more, visit his website, julianvane.com, and take his class at Morbid Anatomy on sigil magic beginning March 17th. You can also join Carl and I for our class on the creative power of the cut-up method, which also includes discussions about sigils, beginning May 19th. See you there. As always, huge thanks to Carl Abrahamson for the intro and outro music for Rendering Unconscious podcast. You can find everything Carl at carlabrahamson.com. That's Carl with a C and Abrahamson with two S's. And now a selection from the album At Stockholm, a collaboration between Carl and Thomas Tibbert as White Stains and Genesis and Paula Peoridge as Psychic TV. Published in 1990, it's just been re-released. You can find it at Bandcamp at highbrowlowlife.bandcamp.com and streaming on Spotify and other streaming services. Enjoy.
In the search for signs, individuals see directions. There was a time zone long ago when feet struggled across blood-biting flint wrapped in animal skin. Bleached bone spoke of the snake way of day. If you imagine a small child with a long ribbon flicking their wrist sharply at each extremity of position, fluidly in the central space, you will picture the flow of life as it was then, regular, like the trails of a serpent on Sahara sand. Each bended knee wrapped in the moisture-preserving layers of nomadic survival, elbow cricked for support. Each bended knee sees what has passed. Time is that which emits, arising like a knighted Templar to scan the four directions. The point of intersection between sky and earth is shimmering, not clear. There is a spinning of equality, mind, body, emotions, and spirit. These come from the simplicity of looking. Hand raised to shield eyes, the fingers of the left hand create a flickering movement like a Venetian blind. It is, of course, a frame, a threshold to travel through in light and to light. We have traveled through time many thousands of years, from ritual wandering towards worlds into language. All ways of closing down our basic nature. All ways of closing down our hope.
Spoiling her nice new clothes.